Okay, welcome to the Second No Ripcord podcast. If you're listening to this, thank you very much for downloading it. I'm features editor Joe Rivers, and I'm here with managing editor Juan Edgardo Rodriguez.
Hello.
And editor-in-chief David Coleman.
Hello.
Okay, and this month we start with a simple question. What have you been doing, and what's been keeping you busy over the last month? Dave, if you'd like to go first.
Okay, well, I've been rather busy not listening to that much music, actually, and not doing too much writing about it either. I'm getting married at the end of the month, and basically been focusing on planning and organising that, which is interesting to me, perhaps not so interesting for listeners, but that's what I've been doing. Perhaps the only vaguely relevant part of that to the podcast is the organising the playlist for the evening and also choosing a song to perform a first dance to. I'm not going to spoil the surprise for some of my friends that might be listening, but that was rather an interesting experience.
So if you're not going to reveal your first dance, are we allowed a preview of what other things might be on the playlist, or is it all a closely guarded secret?
The playlist itself isn't a closely guarded secret. It's been compromised by my girlfriend's liking for chart pop. So whilst I was patting myself on the back for squeezing Atlas by Battles on there, I had to squeeze Katy Perry last Friday night on as well. So it's going to be a fairly varied evening.
I can probably guess already. I think I can guess already whose choices may go down better at a wedding.
I think, yeah, that's the challenge. It's actually quite difficult to cater for an all ages and also Anglo-Swedish crowd as well, because even the sort of classic wedding disco songs that we're used to won't mean anything to a lot of the Swedes there, you know, like sort of Dexys Midnight Runners and things like that. You can't guarantee how big a hit it was and whether people will just sort of raise their eyebrows and say, what are you doing? But I had to have that Battles song on there, you know, and My Bloody Valentine soon is going to be making an appearance at some point in the evening.
You are a brave man.
Possibly sandwiched in between a couple of ABBA songs.
I am scared about the whole My Bloody Valentine thing. I mean, there will be some adults there, a lot of adults there. I mean, somebody may have to, have to leave the room probably because it's going to create quite a racket.
I think you've got to make some sacrifices, and it is my party, and I'll play loud shoegaze music if I want to.
That's what weddings and marriage is all about, I say. Juan, what about you?
Well, I guess I should skip the whole personal life because I really don't have much going on besides just going to move to a new apartment, which I'm pretty psyched about. But let's keep it on the music side. I've been just basically listening to the next few things I'll be reviewing soon for the website. I mean, I was listening to the Brother album quite a lot, but I bestowed the honor to somebody else on that one, so I won't have to review it. So I will review the new War on Drugs album, which I'm really digging a lot. It's called Slave Ambient, and definitely something that even Dave should probably listen to. I'm not sure about Joe, but coming from a background, Kurt Weill used to be in the album as well. And well, I guess you'll have to stick around for the review, but it's probably going to be a quite positive one. I'm really liking it.
Yeah, I feel like I should give those guys a chance. I think I listened to the last album, I believe, but only very briefly, and wrote it off rather quickly, as I kind of did with Kurt Weill as well. So I think, given the dramatic turnaround I made on Kurt Weill, I think they deserve a second chance, as does everyone.
Yeah, and there are some similarities here and there, but I would say that Kurt Vile's is more songwriting centered on certain themes that are more personal, and I guess the Warren Brooks one is more, it's definitely much more an ambient album, I would say. It has quite a few catchy puppy songs that you'll definitely see, but it constantly cuts with these 2 or 3 minute interludes that they're just totally atmospheric, and it sounds really nice because it's a nice blend of some Americana and at the same time some really nice 80s rock and roll. I mean, that's something that to me is sort of missing on guitar bands lately, and I like to see that with the whole psychedelic in there. So yeah, definitely I would recommend that.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, look forward to reading about it.
Okay, so in this July, what I've been doing, other than meeting Dave in a pub and arguing about Suede, is I've been to two festivals. I went to 2000 Trees in Gloucestershire, which was quite a small festival with lots of bands that I hadn't heard of at all, which was really quite enjoyable, and also spent a day at Latitude, which was, again, a great day out, but very much affected by the weather. Which culminated in me having to pay a local farmer to tow the car out with his tractor. Good.
How much did that cost?
£10. He was a very enterprising farmer. And it was 11:30. I'd been at 3 days of festivals. It was pouring with rain. He could have, charged me £100. I just wanted to get home, basically. I was absolutely soaked. And in terms of what I've been listening to, really, based on 2000 Trees, where I saw three Trapped Tigers, who were phenomenal. I'd never even heard of them, but got the album on the basis of their performance, which was really, really fantastic. It's very, very noisy in an absolutely brilliant way. Just really a great thing to stick on and play very, very loudly. At the opposite end of the spectrum, I've been listening to the Washed Out record quite a lot, which is very, very aptly named because it does sound very washed out. And based on the Mercury nominations, which were announced a couple of weeks ago, I've been listening quite a bit to the Ghost Poet album, which is it's very interesting. I'm very much enjoying it.
Is that your tip for the Mercurys then?
No, I don't think it is. I think you've put me on the spot here. I think we'll say PJ Harvey, I think, will win the Mercury Prize, which I think she might be the bookie's favourite anyway, so it's not particularly sticking my neck out too far. But she would be the first person to have won it twice. Should be.
And going back to Washed Out, to sort of rewind there, what do you think of it? Because I am having a few gripes with that one. I really like it in some parts, and some parts I just feel like I'm watching like a runway on television or something, and I can't stand it.
Yeah, it's an odd one in that I can see why you say that, and it's very enjoyable to just have on, and it has a tendency to fade into the background a little bit, but if that's what you're intending it to be, then it's kind of fine, I think.
It's very posh.
Poshcore, we're calling that. That's our new genre of music we just invented.
Don't start that, no.
Okay, I think that'll be the end of part one.
I do want to follow up on something from the last podcast as well. I finally bought the new album, Build a Rocket Boys.
Yes, go.
And I like it.
You...
I like it a bit. I mean, it's not Seldom Seen Kid or anything like that, but I just like how he took the liberty of doing something that sounds like bluntly anthemic, and I think it suits them. I mean, the middle half could use some work here and there, but songs like Open Arms and even The Closer, Dear Friends, I mean, I would put them right on top with some of their best songs.
Okay, welcome to part two, which we are calling the No Ripcord Debate. This month, now that Spotify has been launched in the US, and also a recent report sees that sales of vinyl have gone up 55% in the last year in the UK, we're asking, how do you obtain your music and how do you listen to your music? So, Juan, if you'd like to go first.
Well, I could start just with, I've been fortunate to use Spotify for the last month and a half, and I've been really enjoying it. I'm not sure if it's for everyone's audience, at least in my case, since I'm a big record collector. I do like the fact that you can listen to full albums on Spotify, which is great, and it's something that I can listen to with, of course, if you're not paying, you're going to get some really gruesome commercials. I've been bombasted with, let's say, some Chris Brown while I'm listening to, let's say, Neil Young, which is really not helping me and doesn't help to the experience.
It's not very targeted advertising then.
No, definitely not. But I guess you get what you pay for. I mean, if you're getting it for free, it's great. But if you also want to, I'm not sure how much it is right now. I'm certainly going to research that because I do want that mobile functionality as well.
I believe it's $10, actually, Juan.
$10, yeah. I'm sort of waiting to see what's up with the iCloud as well and see which options would be better for me in that case. But I like the fact that, Spotify doesn't have, such a robust catalog yet, but I think it's getting there, and there are a lot of British albums that I've certainly missed that I've never been able to listen to, or because they're a bit hard to find, and I've actually, sort of Flying Nun stuff and all those things, and I've been finding them, and it's been a joy to hear all that.
So as somebody in America, how does Spotify compare to, say, Rhapsody or Pandora, do you think? Because we don't have those in Europe.
Well, Pandora, in the case of Pandora, you're sort of creating this playlist where it sort of tells you what you're going to listen to. I mean, let's say if you choose a certain artist, it'll just give you a playlist which Pandora itself will guide you along the way and sort of, quote unquote, guide you on what you are listening to and what you should be listening to. Because sometimes I do feel like some bands are just creeping here and there, and it feels like somebody is paying them for it. I mean, it's like I've listened to like 8 different artists, and out of those 8 artists, I'll listen to Death Cab for Cutie like on 6 of those channels when it doesn't even have to do anything with the artist that I'm listening to. And that sort of bothers me. Also, if you're listening to Pandora for like quite a few for a long time, you'll notice that the playlist sort of repeats itself too, and I don't like that unpredictability, especially when the playlists are not that strong.
Okay. So Spotify wins over that then. Well, it's a different kind of thing altogether, I guess.
Definitely, yeah.
So you're currently not paying for Spotify, nor am I. I've got my 10 hours a month limit of music, which I haven't actually been over or close to yet, and yeah, the adverts are annoying, but it's a minor gripe really if you're getting it for free, is my opinion. Dave, are you a Spotify subscriber?
I am, actually. I went over to the premium subscription model, I think, just before Christmas, I believe. I've probably been paying for about 8 months now, and just to for some of the American listeners, I think they haven't introduced that listening cap that you were talking about, Joe, in the States yet. It probably will head over there, but they probably want to get all the kids hooked first before they start sort of withholding the product. That seems to be the sort of business model they're adopting.
You're making them sound like drug dealers, but yeah, okay, there we are.
But it is so good. but I went over to the premium subscription model because I was finding it rather useful, and because I just wanted to have that that sort of mobile functionality, that ability to listen to the playlists that I created on the go, and I find it to be a really good value product. I pay £10 a month, so it's a little bit pricier comparatively than the American package for this, that offers the same service. I can basically fill my iPhone up with, you know, 1,000 plus MP3s, I believe. And I tend to use it to sample new records and new music. Basically, I'd say 90-95% of the new albums that we would review on the website and give a good rating to can be found on there. And I'll use this a sort of best new music type playlist to make sure I'm up to date and listening to all of those. Because it's on the phone, I can stream it to the car stereo, so I'm able to listen to new music on the go on my commute. And I can also stream to the device, so if I'm in a 3G area and I get a desire to hear a certain song, I can safely pull over the vehicle and search for that song, and it's streaming to my car radio in seconds. Even better if you've got a passenger to do it for you. So I think the premium subscription model is an excellent use of £10 a month. When you think that 10 years ago, when I was a student without much money, I wouldn't think twice about going and spending £13-14 on a CD. I basically got more music than I could ever listen to in my lifetime available, you know, just at the click of a button, really. And I can delete things off my phone when I'm getting bored of them, put new things on there. It's brilliant.
So talking about, you used to, you know, £13-14 for a CD, and I remember those dark days too. But do you still buy CDs at all?
I haven't bought a CD. I haven't bought a CD for over a year. The last CD that I bought was Nationals Boxer, and that was purely because I was about 3 places in the queue away from meeting them at a signing, and I needed something for them to sign, and they'd run out of vinyl. I now basically only listen to MP3s and vinyl. MP3s for convenience, vinyl for luxury. If I get a CD promo, I convert it to a decent quality MP3 file and just stick it in the big box that's full of old CDs that I don't guess I'll ever listen to again. If I love an album, I'll make sure I go and find it on vinyl.
So, Juan, what about you? Are you a vinyl junkie as well?
I wouldn't say I'm a vinyl junkie, but I do buy vinyl, and I also buy CDs as well, but that's because I have a setup in which I can get a stereo, good stereo with both the CD, you know, it has a CD player, and it also has a vinyl player. Definitely, I would buy more vinyl eventually when they start perhaps lowering the prices on them, because I don't ever remember vinyl being this expensive, especially from you know, you're buying $20 to $25 on some LPs, at least here in America, it's like that. Yeah, I mean, if it's a more under the radar artist, you'll probably pay like perhaps $15 to $17. But I'm also a bargain hunter, and if I'll get, you know, if I find a CD that's perhaps $8.60 or $9.99. I'll definitely get it over that. And also, I only tend to buy vinyl if it's something that I'm really passionate about. And I also listen to a lot of vinyl if it's a lot of used old vinyl albums. I'll definitely do that, like sort of bargain hunt on the record stores. And if I find like something really great, I mean, I probably have like 5 XTC vinyl, old vinyls, and they haven't been like more than $10, and they all work just as, you know, they work well, and I don't know, I sort of feel like they are sort of spiking the price on those new vinyls. I know that some of them are made on special material, like the 180 gram, which is really nice and all, but sometimes it doesn't feel warranted that you're sort of paying that much for vinyl, like you said. It's more of a luxury in that case.
I think you could be right, absolutely. Because also the market now for CDs, at least, is the kind of the deluxe reissue with rare footage and tracks, and the market is at the higher end, and yeah, it's definitely seen as the luxury item, I think. I'll have to make a confession in that I do not own a turntable. I don't own a CD player, and I've never bought a piece of vinyl in my life. It's something I've always intended to do and will do at some point. And I love the sound and even just the sort of ritual of putting a vinyl record on, or in my case, having someone else put their own vinyl record on their own player. But there's something quite, I don't know, I think there's something quite romantic about it. I don't know if it's something I want to do just from an audiophile point of view, but it's something that I'm planning to get into, and also it's much easier to find cheap second-hand vinyl, at least where I live, than it is cheap second-hand CDs. So I think it's in the same way that with Spotify you can kind of just take a punt on things because it's free. You can do the same with very old vinyl records because they're normally sort of under a pound or something like that.
Yeah, to touch base on that, I definitely feel that vinyl is wholly romanticized. I mean, and I am a supporter of record shops as well, but they do tend to have this whole lamenting story about, oh, we're not buying records and all this, and I don't really completely buy into that because I know that some records stores are going down, but some are really fruitful, and I guess a record store is sort of like a relic. I mean, not much will change. I mean, the audience will still be there, and it won't be that changeable, or that, unless there is some change in the terms of the pricing, which is something that will always sort of stay the same. And going back to the CDs, I mean, like I said, I keep buying them, but I also feel that out of respect to people who buy MP3s for $9.99 on iTunes and stuff like that, which I never do, they should also put competitive prices on compact discs, because it doesn't really take much to manufacture. I mean, the disc itself is quite cheap, so they should sort of like put those hand in hand. I mean, like, put the competitive prices. Like, I know that some record labels have been lowering the prices to compete with all these online stores.
I think, Dave sort of briefly touched upon that, but around a decade, 12 years ago, it really wasn't uncommon to see CDs for sale in the major chains, such as HMV and, at the time, Virgin Megastores, for £16 or £17, whereas now you'd be hard-pressed, I think, to find an album over £10. And I've been into shops and brand new albums on the day of release are available for £8, basically, which, say, 10 years ago would have been unthinkable, really. So I think that is some kind of reaction to that. But although music stores, or at least the chain ones in the UK at least, are just turning more and more of their floor space over to computer games, T-shirts, audio equipment, laptops, and just the CD section is getting smaller and smaller, really.
I think what you touched upon with the pricing and the luxury of the vinyl product is an important point, because I think that the market, the sort of audience that's out there to buy vinyl is essentially the people who are looking back nostalgically, or the audiophiles who are going to pay £20 to buy an album on vinyl, on 180 gram vinyl, and really savor the experience. So there's not really that much point in offering a competitive price for that, because it's a market that is quite committed to buying the physical product, and they'll just accept it, I guess. It's also a slightly older audience as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, we shouldn't forget that the three of us are probably not particularly representative of the population at large in terms of our approach to the buying and consumption of music. So we haven't touched upon things like illegal downloading, but if you're 15, the chances are a lot of the music you obtain is probably not through the most strictly legal of ways. And yeah, there's, I just think, a danger in sort of 15 years' time that's really going to come home to roost with the record industry.
And I increasingly feel bad for the artists, having, you know, it's one sort of question I tend to ask, and if I do an interview with anyone, really, how the current state of the industry is playing out for you. Usually bands on independent labels are more interested in. I think as much as people, respect their fans for coming out to shows and things, I think there is a slight disappointment that I think I put this to Will Sheff when I interviewed him, and I told him that a month or two before the stage names came out. It was the follow-up to that, is it the Stand-Ins? It basically had about 10,000 listeners listening to it on Last.fm, and I put it to him that the album is out in 2 months, yet 10,000 people have listened to it who were signed up to Last.fm, so that's the tip of the iceberg. How many other people have got hold of it illegally? Because there certainly aren't 10,000 people with their own individual promo copy. And, you could see that it really annoyed him. How many of those 10,000 people are going to go and buy the CD copy just because they feel guilty about stealing it when it comes out? Not many. And that's the difference between being able to keep going with a sort of 8-piece touring band and maybe having to call it a day because it just isn't profitable. And I feel for that level of artists, that, hardworking band who are, putting their heart and soul into it and getting shafted, really.
I don't think bands sort of give up because of it. It's very, very unfortunate, and like you, I do feel for them. But I think with most artists, a lot of the reason they make music is more of compulsion. I mean, I think anyone who's saying they don't want to make some sort of money and living out of it is lying, to be honest. But still, I don't think that would actually, the poor sales and people stealing the music would actually stop them making it and calling it a day.
It makes it more difficult to progress, though, and especially if you're touring with 7 or 8 people and trying to put on an impressive production that especially internationally, are you going to see less bands from America being able to make it over to Europe or vice versa? It's a possibility, but who knows? It's a difficult thing to predict the future of the music industry. By the time you've done it, it's already out of date, so I think I'll just sit on the fence on that one.
So, welcome back to part 3, and this is the news and views section where we talk about what's been going on in the world of music this past month, and really, sadly, the overriding story from the past month has been the sad death of Amy Winehouse at the age of just 27. Anyone like to share their views on her life and career, really?
I guess I can go first. Not really a controversial view. It's a terrible, terrible thing to happen to anyone, really. Terrible for her family, terrible for her friends, sad for her fans as well. But I'm not going to pretend that I was a super fan of her work. I think I respected what she did. I would enjoy one of her songs if it came on the radio, but I don't own any of her records. I never really listened extensively to the albums. So from a musical point of view, her death hasn't changed what I think of her as an artist. I just think it's really, really sad. And I think, to live a life under that sort of intense media scrutiny, to have these people in the tabloid press sort of reveling in every mistake you make and splashing it over the front covers, and then doing an about turn and being all devastated and reverential when something like that happens, that was the distasteful aspect of it for me, really.
I think the most saddening part when artists, especially like someone like so regarded by the tabloid and the media, usually the most saddening thing is the aftermath and what comes next and how the news are overblown in that sense. And I mean, I won't deny it. I think we really lost a great voice, and we also lost someone who obviously had a lot of talent, and I wasn't someone who actually, I have some, you know, I have some qualms with some of her albums, and we can talk about that a bit later. But, you know, you can't deny the fact that she had a great voice. I mean, but obviously that, you know, we're going to start comparing, like, oh, artists who died at 27, and then all the cultish, you know, things that come with that. But, you know, just speaking of Winehouse and taking all that out of the context, I definitely see someone who definitely had a lot of talent in her. I mean, yeah.
I think she was incredibly underrated, if you like, was actually as a musician and lyricist. I mean, you're completely right. Her voice, I'd say, is phenomenal. And I speak to someone who would say, as a big fan of her work. I mean, Back to Black was the huge seller in the UK, at least. But I personally prefer her first album, Frank, which just some of the lyrics, the astute observations, and just the way she writes about what it's like to be that age and living in the city and the experiences that you have, I think it's incredible. But I was wondering, Juan, how it's been sort of reported in the US and how much of a star she was really there in the first place, because as Dave touched upon, in the tabloid, especially the Red Tops in the UK, she was, you know, her life was almost lived in the newspapers, sadly, in the last 5 years or so, and reported not always in the most tasteful of ways. And I don't know if she'd really hit those heights of ubiquity in America.
Well, besides just finding out who went to the funeral, because that was, you know, something that was really reported, I would say that Amy Winehouse had the same sort of impact in America as she had in the UK, not only artistically and critically, but also in the media. I mean, I'll sort of come up with a story that I saw a few days ago, which was kind of distasteful, I would say, or how the American media always needs to blow up everything, like, you know, to the next level. Let's say I was channel surfing a few days ago on the TV, and one of these tabloid shows was on the television. It was one of these shows where you can sort of see that the target age range is between 25 to 49, mostly females, I would guess. And they were talking about Amy Winehouse's impact, not only her artistic impact, but how she influenced other artists. And that's what sort of gripes me a little bit, because Christian Horde, he's a writer for Rolling Stone, he was just mentioning about very superficial manners in which she influenced it, just to give the bigger perspective about what type of artist she was to the people who don't know her or who are younger. I mean, they were saying that she had influenced Lady Gaga, and when I saw that in the television, they were just showing that Lady Gaga had this protuberant pompadour with her. They were sort of implying that it was just in that image, you know, in that image sense. And then they went on to describe how she influenced Adele with the whole neo-soul thing, and I found that was really disrespectful to Adele as well, because didn't these two artists, like, got a lot of, you know, influence from artists like Carole King or Billie Holiday or, you know, all that real building pop and all these artists, and I just found out that it was just sort of disrespectful. I mean, it was a tabloid magazine format, but you know, that's what many people will, you know, will just get out of that story. And I didn't care. I was indifferent, but it also sort of made me a bit mad.
I think it's just the way those programs work. If you, you know your target audience and know your reference points, and as sad as that is, that's just how that's going. Hypothetically, the researchers on the program, the people on the program might have known full well that it's actually, as you say, Carole King, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, who were the people they should have been mentioning, but could have said, well, there's no point. The people who are watching this aren't going to care about that.
But that would be their cue to switch off. Carol who? Let's see what's on the other channel. Yeah, it's sad, isn't it? It's a sad reflection of that sort of demographic, really.
And going back to Frank, I mean, it's like I said, I may ruffle a few feathers with this comment, but you also mentioned the things about Frank that I did like, because the things that I disliked about her career as an artist was this whole, you know, this woe is me, I'm a tortured artist and attitude, which is something that some people can get out of it. And that's the part I didn't like about her career. It's something that I didn't like about other artists, like, for example, someone like Elliott Smith or other artists like that. I never liked that side. I just like the more, you know, the things that we should celebrate an artist for, not what was about to happen, because we didn't expect this to happen. But then we start making all these compares and all these contrasts, and that's where it gets ugly.
I don't know if she was, I disagree with that, I don't know if she was sort of woe is me, if you like. She, maybe often some of her lyrics looked at the darker side of life, and especially relationships and, you know, breakups and things like that, but I wouldn't go as far as to say she was sort of particularly self-pitying, or that you could really sort of retrospectively go back and give or try and put interpretations on top of what's already what she already wrote in light of the events. I don't know if I'd agree with you on that one, really.
Yeah.
We're agreeing to disagree, I guess.
We'll agree to disagree, and in which case we'll leave part three there. Welcome to part four. This is the No Ripcord Show and Tell, where each month one of us will bring in something they think is interesting, and the others will listen to it, and we'll take it from there and see how it goes. This month, we've been listening to the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. The BBC Radiophonic Workshop was opened in 1958 with the brief of producing imaginative sounds for radio productions. As well as being at the forefront of electronics, the workshop used a wide variety of instruments, voices, and session musicians. It wasn't long before the workshop branched out into television, earning commissions from, amongst others, comedian Spike Milligan. The recorded output of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop showcases the evolving technologies of production and sound manipulation. Originally making use of the analogue sampling techniques favoured by music concrete artists, over the years they moved through synthesizers, keyboards, sequencers and samplers before fully moving into the age of digital. Sadly, the workshop wasn't the most profitable arm of the BBC, and spiralling costs meant the unit closed down in 1998, exactly 40 years to the day after it opened. However, its influence has been recognised far and wide, from the groundbreaking techniques they use to, arguably, their creation of what we now call modern-day electronic music. Now, the three tracks we listened to were Music for a Magic Carpet from 1961, Radio Blackburn from 1980, and the very well-known Doctor Who theme from 1963. I
must say it was quite an interesting experience, because I've heard a lot about the influence of the Radiophonic Workshop. Obviously familiar, as I would hope every member of the British public is, with the Doctor Who theme, which is an iconic TV theme. Read a lot about the workshop, read about stories of some of the composers like Delia Derbyshire, some of the more well-known ones, and obviously you heard a lot of electronic musicians referring to this as a major influence. But prior to this, to listening to this for the podcast, I hadn't really sat down and listened to some of the other material in a sort of extensive manner. And these three tracks sort of welcomed me into this world. And I must say, it's startling how groundbreaking some of the stuff from as far back as the early 60s sounds. The music for Magic Carpet is 50 years old, and it sounds like it could have been created within the last 10 years easily. You can hear straight away, just from a first listen, the influence of this, not just extending to electronic music, but also into hip hop and pop in general. Doctor Who, I still particularly enjoy and think it's well known for a reason. It's probably the finest example of the workshop's work that I've heard. And that isn't just a sort of revised opinion from the last sort of 10, 15 years since the workshop closed down. In researching this, I actually discovered that as far back as 1971, Pink Floyd actually sampled the Doctor Who theme for one of the tracks from the Metal album, One of These Days. How's that for research, eh, Joe?
I did not know that.
That's an interesting fact, yeah.
It is very much.
More well known is that Orbital also sampled it as well. But when you can influence Pink Floyd and Orbital, and a whole host of other electronic musicians with one iconic piece of music, you've obviously done something right.
Yeah.
The only track of the three that I did enjoy but didn't rate quite as highly as the others was the Radio Blackburn piece, which I thought, given that it was produced in 1980, I felt didn't quite sound as visionary as the earlier work. It sounded more like the composer was keeping up with what was going on at the time rather than forging new ground. If you bear in mind that this was recorded, say, 3 years after a groundbreaking album like Trans-Europe Express, I think it doesn't quite sound as forward-thinking as the Doctor Who theme or Music for a Magic Carpet, but still very, very well worth hearing. I will be listening more to the Radiophonic Workshop as a result of this show and tell, so thanks for bringing it to the table.
I feel my work is done. Fantastic. Juan, what were your thoughts?
I mean, this was something completely new for me. This is like a big archive of, I would say, right? It's like a big archive of material, which some of it obviously is groundbreaking at the least. But I mean, I definitely enjoyed the tracks that you sent me. Even if I'm not a big fan of Doctor Who, I could recognize that as well, because it's pretty iconic, I would say, as well. But I'm definitely going to check out more about this workshop. I mean, so its demise was in 1998, you said?
Yeah, just basically, they were never really sort of as recording artists as such with commercial releases. They were basically just created to as just a department of the BBC to come up with some incidental music to start with. I don't know if it's because of the technology they used or so on, but it was just by the end a lot of the things were being outsourced anyway to other companies, other musicians, and when it did close in 1998, there was actually only one person still working there full time. So I think it was just because of just budget cuts, really, and it's very sad that the commercialism sort of won over, really, and it just wasn't commercially viable to stick with it.
Yeah, and they even did like a reunion show about that too, and I saw some bits of that, and it was really, it was just fun. I mean, and I guess it's one of those things where it was sadly, due to I don't know if it's which reasons, budget cuts or political reasons or whatnot, but it's really sad to see that go too.
Yeah, I mean, it's the as someone sort of who's obviously a very big fan of music, I just quite enjoy sort of going back in time and seeing where the artists that I like today sort of got their influences from, where they came from. And I mean, I quite like sort of Kraftwerk and Krautrock, but I'm quite a big fan of Broadcast and Stereolab. And that's the kind of thing you can really hear in there, I think. And as Dave touched upon, it's incredible, really, that some of that stuff's 50 years old. I mean, Dave mentioned, say, Trans Europe Express is 1977, but there's what we would call electronic music being made 15, 16 years before that.
I mean, it was very forward thinking, I could definitely get from that. And we still see a lot of artists, like, taking cues from that as well. I mean, isn't pretty much the construct of bedroom electronic music born out of that too? I mean, definitely.
I think so, yeah. Okay, so that was Music for a Magic Carpet, Radio Blackburn, and of course the Doctor Who theme. So that wraps up this second No Ripcord podcast. Many thanks from myself, Juan, and Dave for listening. You'll be played out with two tracks from the bands on your new favourite band feature. First will be Miracle Parade, and that'll be followed by the band You Are My Symphonic. So all that remains to say is thanks for listening again. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/noripcordmagazine and twitter.com/noripcord. And please feel free to leave comments and get in touch. Let us know what you thought and any future questions for the next podcast. Okay, thanks for listening. Bye-bye. So now I'm not a gambling man. It seems I risked it all this time for the words I've lost. That Eastern girl made forever on my mind. I'll trace the lines and name the patterns made. And there are constellation marks, a path I pray won't fade. For if you send her to my arms, I'll get down on one knee. And with an honest heart, she'll make an honest man of me. Even if it can't be.